You freeze. Your junior designer, who somehow just snuck into your meeting, has just opened their mouth and started talking to the client about changing the design. You feel the cold sweat dripping down your face. Panic sets in. What are they going to say? They don't know the scope, the budget, the timeline. They're going to ruin everything. But are they? Well, if you, like me, are a bit nervous about getting your team in front of the client, keep listening, because on today's podcast, we're going to discuss how we can make it work and the benefits of having our team in front of our clients. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Ben Ashton, founder of the Digital Project Manager. Welcome to the DPM podcast. We're on a mission to help project managers succeed, to help people who manage projects deliver better. We're here to help you take your project game to the next level. Check out the digitalprojectmanager.com to learn about our training and resources we offer through membership. This podcast is brought to you by Clarizen, the leader in enterprise project and portfolio management software. Visit clarizen.com to learn more. So today I'm joined by Michael Luchin, and Michael is one of our resident DPM experts. He's a product coach at Crema, and they're a digital product agency, and they create web and mobile apps. And he works out of DC. He works remotely, helping people collaborate, analyze, and solve complex problems, working with clients like Callaway Golf, Tiller, and a top global consulting firm as well. So Michael, so good to have you with us today.
So good to be here.
Now, I was actually just talking to you before that we started recording the show, and I did warn you that I'd been stalking you on YouTube. And if you haven't stalked Michael on YouTube, go ahead and do it. It's fun. But in one of the videos, it gave an overlay. It said Michael speaks Greek and geek, and he's a good dancer. So, tell us about these three things. Obviously, I believe that you're a geek. That much I can believe. But tell us about speaking Greek. Is this true?
Yeah. Well, I'll say of those three things, two of those three things are true. One is not. So yes, I am definitely most absolutely a geek. And I do speak a bit of Greek. I'm not a good dancer.
Oh, well, that's disappointing. I was hoping maybe as a feature we could have a little dance something, but that'll have to wait for another time. How did you get to learning Greek? Is that a family thing?
Yeah, my wife is Greek, uh-huh. So her whole side of the family is Greek, and my life is basically like the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding. If you've ever seen that.
I've not, but I'm aware of it. Yes. Good luck with that then. Is that, yeah, sure it is. So tell us, apart from, Greek, where do you go to get inspired? I know that you produce a lot of content for Crema, inspiring other people. But where do you get your inspiration from?
Yeah. So I'm a huge, RSS junkie. So I have a Feedbin account where I subscribe to a bunch of various DPM blogs and sites and just general tech news newsletters. Substack is really taking off right now, so I've subscribed to some newsletters over there, and then of course on Twitter I like to follow any product leaders I can find, and it's just being able to taking all of that, it's a lot, but taking in all of that has really kind of given me a way to kind of tap into like how our field is always moving forward and where I can help innovate next.
Yeah. Is there any in particular that you've are enjoying at the moment?
I really like Silicon Valley Product Group. Great newsletter from Marty Kagan that he's putting out on a pretty regular basis right now. And then I also like following John Cutler on Twitter with his insights.
Nice. I just say one thing that I always enjoy reading is The Hustle have a newsletter. I don't know if you follow that, but it's more kind of like macro insights just on how the world is evolving, changing, but often technology skewed. But they have lots of analysts who produce are very readable insights on how the world is changing and evolving. So if you haven't checked that out, check out The Hustle. It's a fun read. And tell us what are you trying to get better at? I know in our podcast recently, we talked about you taking on this role as a product coach. What are you personally trying to develop and get better at, and how are you doing that?
Yeah. So specifically within that realm of coaching, it's about trying to find that right balance between being a guide and a leader, but also like being able to step back from those that I'm coaching to kind of maybe fall down on their own a little bit so that they can learn to pick themselves up. It's especially in like client services, that is such an ambiguous gray area, and yeah. It's so tough to navigate. But I'm convinced that if that is something that I can get better at, that there's something real of really unique value there.
Mm, that's cool. And have you found, you know, maybe as you're coaching or just as you've just been discovering and getting inspired, have you found anything that is making your life awesome? Maybe that's in the remote project management space or discipline or through your coaching. Have you discovered anything that you've been able to apply that's really working out well for you?
Yeah. So right now, I'm a huge fan of the collaborative whiteboard tool Miro, just for everything. Especially right now as we're recording this with the COVID crisis and everybody's forced to be remote, allows my team and I to feel like we're actually in the room collaborating together. But it goes beyond that too. Like just on one project I'm on right now, we've been having ongoing design collaboration discussions on a shared Miro whiteboard for the last like few weeks, which is a huge productivity gain from the once a week only design meeting that we would have. So it's awesome on so many levels.
Nice. Yeah. So we'll stick a link in the show notes, but it's Miro.com, right? And you can, I think they do free trials and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's worth checking out. So let's get back to your post in this topic of having your team talk directly with the client. And I think this is an interesting one because so often in my experience, having the team in the client or directly liaising or talking with the client can be a complete disaster. And in fact, so much so that I've written a rules of client engagement, a guide to managing your team in client meetings that you can find in our membership area. So if you find that your team just aren't toeing the line, check out that rules of client engagement. And we shared this as a case study on the digital project management a while back, but I wanted to circle back around and talk through it philosophically and practically with Michael just to kind of get his take, because I think we've got maybe opposing views on how well this works. So I'm going to start with my beef, the things that I've seen go wrong when we do this, and then you can tell me why you think it's still worth it. And I think where I net out is that I'm usually not confident enough in my team or the client to do or say the right thing. And I find that in my role, I'm this kind of delicate glue that actually helps keep people together, but also apart enough so that they don't hate one another or torpedo the relationship. Because what I often see is that the team forget that they're actually representing the agency. They can't just say whatever they like. When they're saying, you know, something, actually they're representing the agency. They can't just say, hey, client, your brand totally sucks, or they hate you. You know, I hate your idea. Often I find the team's unprepared for the meeting. Maybe our team's not very nice because they're bitter about clients' feedback. When a client says, hey, that design really sucked. Who did the design? It really sucked. And they get bitter about it and they can't let go of it. Maybe the team is unrealistic. They make commitments that they can't keep. Or they talk about mistakes that we've made that maybe they shouldn't do. Or they start talking about scope and budgets and timelines. But in your post, you kind of assume that this is a good idea. And philosophically, I think I agree. But let's start with the why. Why do you think this is a good idea?
Yeah, well, simply, I think it helps the clients achieve results much more efficiently and effectively when they're directly collaborating with the team. And I totally, you know, coming off of your points there, I totally get them. I hear what that is. Honestly, those same points were something that I held close to my chest for a few years before kind of looking at this way of like, well, what if we really did trust the team and allow the team to help lead the client and lean into that trust by default? And going down that path for me, and still is to this day, incredibly hard because as a PM, I want to be in control. I have that drive to. My role is specifically around like that aspect of it, but it's kind of ironic in a way is that by giving up control and focusing not on the people, but more the environment that they collaborate in, inclusive of the client, then those points, those problems, those potential problems become mute.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about then in real terms, what this collaboration looked like for you. So, I mean, I think, yeah, the crux of this comes down to control and whether or not we can, I guess, trust our teammates, trust the client to say the right things, to be nice to one another, and to, for the benefits of that to outweigh the cost of potentially torpedoing everything. So in your experience, like how you've made this collaboration work, is that sending one another emails, calling one another in Slack together, just in meetings together? Because I think the intensity and the frequency probably matter here in terms of, you know, where we're giving a long leash and where we're kind of reining things in a bit.
Yeah. So just from a very foundational perspective, using Scrum as kind of a guideline framework, we generally operate in 2-week sprints, which means we're going to have a sprint retrospective, a product backlog review, and a sprint kickoff planning session. The client is involved in all of those. It's something that we ask really and strongly recommend for the client to do. And the reason for that is because as we're actually going through the retrospective and the team is saying things, which could include sometimes things that maybe the client doesn't necessarily want to hear, there's value in getting that conversation out and being able to have that trusted, safe conversation. And the product backlog review, and if the client is asking to prioritize a massive new feature without any discovery or ideation or exploration into it, the team is able to say, well, no, like this is no, why should we go about this right now? We need to consider technical discovery. We need to consider maybe making a design prototype to validate this with the user, and allows those conversations to be had. And simply put, I approach it from treating our clients in that world as the product owner role. And sometimes they may get that right away. Sometimes it might take time for them to understand like what that means just through experience. We've had that experience definitely in the past, but always at least a little bit into those engagements that really starts to take root. And then that's where, in addition to those standing meetings, we also use Slack with our clients, and we create shared channels where our clients are actually in those channels with our team, so that we can really lean into that value.
So I will bring up, you know, I think what I think will be a classic scenario, and that will be that the creative director and the design team have come up with a design that they think is perfect. And, you know, maybe it has been validated in some way through insights or testing, but you present it to the client and the client's like, no, I want this. You know, the classic, I want my logo bigger, or I want this, I want that. And ultimately the client's paying for it. And so how do you balance doing the right thing with the client's paying for it, and therefore they get to decide what happens? How do you balance that aspect without the client turning around and saying, look, I've asked 100 times now, just do what I want?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's definitely one of a scenario that I've had happen repeatedly. I think the immediate thing to do is, and this is something I have conversations with my team members about, is to take a posture of education for the client. So in the design example, it might be explaining, well, this is, you know, why it's been validated by users. This is why this is going to mean results for what we're actually building for you, and thus results for your role to the client. And really being able to take a lean in that posture of education for the client, telling them why, showing them why, not necessarily backing down right away, which is hard to do. But when you, with practice, like in with that idea of I'm really hired to help educate and teach the client to make a good educated decision, you can. Now, there are times where the client is going to have forces behind them that might be moving that they may not necessarily, for one reason or another, make visible. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but to be flexible with that, if they continue to want to push forward, then yeah, you can go forward with what they're suggesting, but only after you have that conversation, so that you can consider it later in the, down the road in the backlog to come back to or revisit as a good learning experience.
Cool. And so you talked about, having the team engaged in this discussion with the client, challenging the client when they're making bad decisions. But what were the kind of steps you, took your team through in order to prepare them for doing that in an appropriate way, without people getting upset or without, you know, torpedoing the relationship? Did you have any rules of engagement like I do in terms of, hey, you can come to this meeting, but here are the rules? How did you train and prepare your team to engage with the client in a, you know, a kind of white glove way where you kind of maintain the relationship, but also are real with them about what should be done or what should not be done?
Yeah. So I can definitely go really deep on this one, but I think simply, like, the simple takeaway is asking the team just to be transparent with their thoughts and share them, even if they feel hesitant around that. And from there comes opportunities to, of course, fine tune and grow your team on how to continuously engage with clients in potentially heated discussions or what might feel like heated discussions. But really just by saying, like, take a posture of, like, say things, you know, make sure we're not, like, leaving these until after the meeting, can just open up so much value.
And you talked about, you know, your team being apprehensive about it at first. Now, obviously, as PMs, we can be apprehensive because we're like, hey, team, please don't say something stupid in the meeting, because this is a really important piece of work for us. This is an important client. But likewise, from our team's perspective, they can adopt a similar perspective in so far as thinking, hey, I don't want to have to talk to the client. Like, I don't like this client. They are annoying. They don't speak my language. But why, you talk in your article about that changing over time for your team. So how did they transition from this apprehensiveness to, I guess, more confidence in being direct with the client?
It takes time and just comfort and experience, I think, to move on from that. And just a little bit of from like a Scrum Master perspective, like the Scrum Master serves as a coach, and I love that metaphor in any project team. And so if you take that perspective and you're like, you know, you might want to suggest this to the client just through normal conversations, then that can be really great experience. So often in our roles, we have conversations every day with our team where they're like maybe bringing up an idea or maybe even a frustration about how a client is perceiving something. And it can be an easy knee-jerk reaction, I think, for us as PMs to say, oh, cool, like, let me dive into that with you, and then I will take that to the client and then come back to you. And that creates a bottleneck and a translation issue potentially too. And so rather than go down that path, I love to always lean into those discussions like, hey, why don't you actually reach out to the client on Slack about that? Or why don't you bring that up on this call? And what I always like to do along those lines too is offer the team member I'm talking to a crutch of, hey, I can help you facilitate that conversation if you like, because I understand that it might be a little challenging for them.
Right.
More often than not, I am not taken up on that offer, and they move forward with engaging in that discussion with the client.
Okay. So practically though, on the flip side of that, so that's kind of best case scenario. How do you keep the client then from bugging the team about things, interrupting them? You're talking about encouraging the team to go well, the team starts going around you then. So how are you keeping, if you've got, you know, a big team, you've got UX talking to the client, design, dev, everyone's having this conversation as though they were the product owner. How do you maintain any sense of control when these conversations are happening around you and you're not, I guess, in the center of that?
I think it comes down to facilitated alignment. Like the metaphor I'm really thinking about is just kind of that like silent guiding hand, not a controlling hand, but rather a guiding hand. And so it's about, to me, it's about setting up each sprint, each release around in a shared aligned vision of what is the outcome that we're trying to generate here. So for each sprint, that might mean setting a sprint goal and aligning around that. For writing user stories, it might mean not diving into the weeds of how very specific design acceptance criteria should look, but rather focusing on outcome-driven acceptance criteria to give the team a little bit of room to find the best solutions and collaborate along the way. It's about finding, in general, it's about finding that kind of that vague gray area of having control, but also having being comfortable with a certain amount of control that you don't have, so that ultimately you have control of getting those results. It's very weird, but and it's a very challenging concept, even for me every day. but constantly, those results have been proven by leaning into this anxiety-inducing path that does lead to these amazing outcomes for the team.
And so, have you found that it's worked better with some clients and some team members than others? I think what you're talking about is this utopia in my mind of, you know, just kind of let them at it and release them, and you know, everyone starts playing nicely together. But is it the case that this has worked across the board?
You know, there are definitely going to be challenge clients or in interactions, and I don't want to say like challenge clients and that challenge clients are challenging, more so just like misalignments with personalities and team members and clients, etc. I think that goes back to like kind of where that like guiding, coaching, team member role that we play comes into play. That you're having these conversations and you're going to have frustrations of, you know, the client's just not understanding it, or even the client might be saying these things to you about your team. And it's about then in turn taking a stance of, well, let's dive into that. Like, why do we feel this way? And how might we, moving forward, have more productive conversations? All without going back to this kind of the stance of saying, let's only have the PM role and the client collaborate in silo from then on out. But instead, rather, how might you help those relationships grow from the problems that might be occurring?
Yeah. I think I would also propose one reason why I know that, or why I think this works in your scenario so well, is the underlying engagement model. And that is that the way that your clients are typically engaging with you relies on a certain amount of trust in the first instance, right? Because you typically sell and engage with clients on a, you know, you're buying a team for a certain number of sprints, and the deliverables are often quite loosely defined. So even within the engagement model, there's a level of trust that's implied in the first instance. And maybe that helps trickle down to the workings of the project, because the client trusts that the team has their best interests at heart. The team know that the client is trusting them, because things are, you know, everything's up for grabs. And maybe that helps with the client not being worried about the team taking advantage of them in some way. And, you know, conversely, the team thinking, hey, this client is giving us a lot of leeway and scope. Nothing has been fully defined. Everything's up for grabs, rather than a more tightly defined project with a kind of fixed budget, fixed scope, fixed timeline, and everyone's just kind of struggling and pushing to deliver to that. And where, because everyone's trying to make as much profit as they can or get things done as cheaply as they can on the client side, people are then more, I guess, incented to cut corners or approach things in a less collaborative way?
Yeah, absolutely. The model, the contract model that we have, duration and price, does play a role in helping create kind of the structure of the environment to have this kind of organic means of client and team collaboration. We definitely have challenges from time to time where, the client might try to treat it as if it's a defined scope engagement. But again, right, those conversations are enabled by that framework. And what I love about it too, just as being a PM within that role, within that type of contract engagement, is it really truly does allow me to lean into the posture of being a coach and being a mentor to the team members and also the client of, this is what ideal collaboration looks like. How can we get there, knowing that each engagement, each personality is different.
Yeah. And so in your experience though, obviously you've been talking about things going well, but where things do fall apart for you, what has happened when it hasn't worked? What are your fail stories of this?
Yeah. I can think of a lot of examples. Of course, examples that have been resolved.
Right.
Because again, it goes back to just how this is naturally set up. And so, I can think of one example where things were going well, and the client had grown away from maybe some old like waterfall notions of expectations into more agile notions, and then for whatever reason, due to stakeholder pressures or other factors, the client reverted to that, and it frustrated the team. It made the team feel burned out and not heard and wanting to check out. And at that point, this is really where, like, I think there becomes a whole kind of psychological component of it. I see these conversations happening in Slack, for example, and I might intentionally wait overnight to then engage with my team and say, "Hey, on a Zoom call, what do you think? What was that yesterday?" Mm-hmm. And just having that conversation to talk through it, and then also, from my angle, provide a perspective of looking at the other side of the coin, from like the client's perspective, then that allows the team to be rejuvenated. And then in this example, they were willing to re-engage in collaboration, move forward on a positive foot, and understand the other perspective of that. And it's challenging, but at the same time, like, this just leads to so much better collaboration and so much better outcomes. When you take that facilitation role of having kind of an indirect but guiding hand in helping drive the team forward through these challenging scenarios to help keep things on track, trying to build and what the client desires.
Yeah, I think it's interesting kind of how you frame it. And to me, what it sounds like is your role becomes this empathy coach, and it's almost as if how you might actually work with your kids, if you have kids, helping people to understand maybe the other person's perspective, and how they might be feeling or thinking, or why they might be doing what they're doing, why they might be saying what they're saying, and rather than just taking things at face value, digging a bit deeper, so that you can try to understand before you kind of react to it. But to someone who's kind of new to all this, who, like me, maybe has got their fingers burnt in the past by having a designer start talking to the client about changing the design when there's no budget or there's no real scope for them to do that, what would you recommend? Where do you think a good place to start is? For beginning to get your clients and your team engaging more directly with one another, with the purpose and the intent really of speeding up the process, of increasing the quality and value of the thing that you're producing. Where would you start with that?
So really focusing on leading with experiments and saying, like, for example, like, hey, let's take a more agile approach to these next couple of weeks. Let's take a more different approach where client, you're going to play the product owner role, and then the team, you're going to be collaborating directly with the client. I'm going to be here as a facilitator to help with those types of conversations. If we need to do any sort of like design thinking exercises or anything like that during a sprint, we can do that. But being able to set up that experimentation posture allows you in turn, as somebody doing this for the first time, to give yourself some grace, which is so important, because there's going to be days where you're going to start going down this path and you're going to feel emotionally beat. And you're going to think, wow, this is really difficult. And this is why I think I think so few product leaders do this, is because what's hard about our jobs isn't, not to diminish it, but it isn't always just like writing user stories and helping figure out like, what are we going to build next? Those are tactics that can be learned. But I think what is truly the most difficult part of our job is when you lean into kind of that empathy coach type posture, as you mentioned, that allows us to help multiply our team's abilities and allows the results to be driven forward more effectively and more efficiently, and everybody to be collaborating together really well. But it's so hard to do that because you're letting go of control, but at the same time, you're not letting go of control because you're creating and iterating on carefully managed like bumper lanes in a bowling alley, as I like to use it as a terrible metaphor. But it allows that to happen. And if you give yourself that experimentation time and you even maybe tell your team and your clients, hey, this is an experiment, I think that can be a really good place to start and figure out how does this look like for you and your team.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great having you with us today.
Thank you.
And I'd love to know what you think. How does having your team talking with a client work for you? Does it work? Does it not work? Is your experience like Michael's, where it becomes this beautiful, synergistic relationship where beautiful things happen, or do you end up in complete disaster? I'd love to know what works and what doesn't work for you. Tell us your fail stories. Tell us your wins of this working, all in the comments below. And if you want to learn more and get ahead in your work, come and join our tribe with DPM membership. Head to thedigitalprojectmanager.com/membership and you'll get access to our Slack team, templates and samples, workshops, office hours, ebooks and more. And if you like what you heard today, please subscribe and stay in touch on thedigitalprojectmanager.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.